Part 1. Wu Li. Chapter 1. Big Week at Big Sur. When I tell my friends that I study physics, they move their heads from side to side, they shake their hands at the wrist, and they whistle, "Whew, that's difficult." This universal reaction to the word physics is a wall that stands between what physicists do and what most people think they do. There is usually a big difference between the two. Physicists themselves are partly to blame for this sad situation. Their shop talk sounds like advanced Greek unless you are Greek or a physicist. When they are not talking to other physicists, physicists speak English. Ask them what they do, however, and they sound like the natives of Corfu again. On the other hand, part of the blame is ours. Generally speaking, we have given up trying to understand what physicists and biologists, etc., really do. In this, we do ourselves a disservice. These people are engaged in extremely interesting adventures that are not that difficult to understand. True, how they do what they do sometimes entails a technical explanation which, if you are not an expert, can produce an involuntary deep sleep. What physicists do, however, is actually quite simple. They wonder what the universe is really made of, how it works, what we are doing in it, and where it is going, if it is going any place at all. In short, they do the same things that we do on starry nights when we look up at the vastness of the universe and feel overwhelmed by it, and a part of it at the same time. That is what physicists really do, and the clever rascals get paid for doing it. Unfortunately, when most people think of physics, they think of chalkboards covered with undecipherable symbols of an unknown mathematics. The fact is that physics is not mathematics. Physics, in essence, is simple wonder at the way things are, and a divine, some call it compulsive, interest in how that is so. Mathematics is the tool of physics. Stripped of mathematics, physics becomes pure enchantment. I had spoken often to Jack Sarfati, who is the physicist director of the Physics Consciousness Research Group, about the possibility of writing a book, unencumbered with technicalities and mathematics, to explain the exciting insights that motivate current physics. So when he invited me to a conference on physics that he and Michael Murphy were arranging at the Esalen Institute, I accepted with a purpose. The Esalen Institute, it is named for an Indian tribe, is in Northern California. The Northern California coast is an awesome combination of power and beauty, but nowhere so much as along the Pacific Coast Highway between the towns of Big Sur and San Luis Obispo. The Esalen facilities are located about a half hour south of Big Sur, between the highway and the coastal mountains on the one side, and rugged cliffs overlooking the Pacific Ocean on the other. A dancing stream divides the northern third of the grounds from the remainder. On that side is a big house, called the Big House, where guests stay and groups meet, along with a small home where Dick Price, co-founder of Esalen with Murphy, stays with his family. On the other side of the stream is a lodge where meals are served and meetings are held, accommodations for guests and staff, and hot sulfur baths. Dinner at Esalen is a multi-dimensional experience. The elements are candlelight, organic food, and a contagious naturalness that is the essence of the Esalen experience. Sarfati and I joined two men who already were eating. One was David Finkelstein, a physicist from Yeshiva University in New York, who was attending the conference on physics. The other was Ao Chung-Liang Huang, a Tai Chi master who was leading a workshop at Esalen. We could not have chosen better companions. The conversation soon turned to physics. "When I studied physics in Taiwan," said Huang, "we called it Wu Li. It means patterns of organic energy." Everyone at the table was taken at once by this image. Mental lights flashed on one by one as the idea penetrated. Wu Li was more than poetic. It was the best definition of physics that the conference would produce. It caught that certain something, that living quality that we were seeking to express in a book, that thing without which physics becomes sterile. "Let's write a book about Wu Li," I heard myself exclaim. Immediately, ideas and energy began to flow, and in one stroke all of the prior planning that I had done went out the window. From that pooling of energy came the image of the dancing Wu Li masters. My remaining days at Esalen and those that followed were devoted to finding out what Wu Li masters are and why they dance. All of us sensed with excitement and certitude that we had discovered the channel through which the very things that we wanted to say about physics would flow. The Chinese language does not use an alphabet like Western languages. Each word in Chinese is depicted by a character, which is a line drawing. Sometimes two or more characters are combined to form different meanings. This is why it is difficult to translate Chinese into English. Good translations require a translator who is both a poet and a linguist. For example, Wu, W-U, can mean either matter or energy. Li, L-I, is a richly poetic word. It means universal order or universal law. It also means organic patterns. The grain in a panel of wood is Li. The organic pattern on the surface of a leaf is also Li, and so is the texture of a rose petal. In short, Wu Li, the Chinese word for physics, means patterns of organic energy. Matter slash energy, Wu, plus universal order slash organic patterns, Li. This is remarkable, since it reflects a worldview which the founders of Western science, Galileo and Newton, simply did not comprehend, but toward which virtually every physical theory of import in the 20th century is pointing. The question is not, do they know something that we don't? The question is, how do they know it? English words can be pronounced almost any way without changing their meanings. I was 5 years a college graduate before I learned to pronounce consummate as an adjective. It means carried to the utmost extent or degree, perfect. I live in anguish when I think of the times that I have spoken of consummate linguists, consummate scholars, etc. Someone always seemed to be holding back a smile, almost. I learned later that these were the people who read dictionaries. Nonetheless, my bad pronunciation never prevented me from being understood. That is because inflections do not change the denotation of an English word. No, spoken with a rising inflection, no. With a downward inflection, no. And with no inflection, no. All mean, according to the dictionary, a denial, a refusal, negative. This is not so in Chinese. Most Chinese syllables can be pronounced several different ways. Each different pronunciation is a different word which is written differently and which has a meaning of its own. Therefore, the same syllable, pronounced with different inflections, which unaccustomed Western listeners scarcely can distinguish, constitutes distinctly separate words, each with its own ideogram and meaning, to a Chinese listener. In English, which is an atonal language, these different ideograms are all written and pronounced the same way. For example, there are over 80 different wus in Chinese, all of which are spelled and pronounced the same way in English. Al Huang has taken 5 of these wus, each of which, when combined with Li, produces a different Wu Li, each with the same English spelling, and each pronounced in English Wu Li. The first Wu Li means patterns of organic energy. This is the Chinese way of saying physics. Wu means matter or energy. The second Wu Li means my way. Wu means mine or self. The third Wu Li means nonsense. Wu means void or non-being. The fourth Wu Li means I clutch my ideas. Wu means to make a fist or clutch with a closed hand. The fifth Wu Li means enlightenment. Wu means enlightenment or my heart slash my mind. If we were to stand behind a master weaver as he begins to work his loom, we would see at first not cloth, but a multitude of brightly colored threads from which he picks and chooses with his expert eye and feeds into the moving shuttle. As we continue to watch, the threads blend one into the other, a fabric appears, and on the fabric, behold, a pattern emerges. In a similar manner, Al Huang has created a beautiful tapestry from his own epistemological loom. Physics equals Wu Li. Wu Li equals patterns of organic energy. Wu Li equals my way. Wu Li equals nonsense. Wu Li equals I clutch my ideas. Wu Li equals enlightenment. Each of the physicists at the conference to a person reported a resonance with this rich metaphor. Here at last was the vehicle through which we could present the seminal elements of advanced physics. By the end of the week, everyone at Esalen was talking about Wu Li. At the same time that this was happening, I was trying to find out what a master is. The dictionary was no help. All of its definitions involved an element of control. This did not fit easily into our image of the dancing Wu Li masters. Since Al Huang is a Tai Chi master, I asked him. "That is the word that other people use to describe me," he said. To Al Huang, Al Huang was just Al Huang. Later in the week, I asked him the same question again, hoping to get a more tangible answer. "A master is someone who started before you did," was what I got that time. My Western education left me unable to accept a non-definition for my definition of a master, so I began to read Huang's book, Embrace Tiger, Return to Mountain. There, in the foreword by Alan Watts, in a paragraph describing Al Huang, I found what I sought. Said Alan Watts of Al Huang, "He begins from the center and not from the fringe. He imparts an understanding of the basic principles of the art before going on to the meticulous details, and he refuses to break down the Tai Chi movements into a 1-2-3 drill so as to make the student into a robot. The traditional way is to teach by rote and to give the impression that long periods of boredom are the most essential part of training. In that way, a student may go on for years and years without ever getting the feel of what he is doing." Here was just the definition of a master that I sought. A master teaches essence. When the essence is perceived, he teaches what is necessary to expand the perception. The Wu Li master does not speak of gravity until the student stands in wonder at the flower petal falling to the ground. He does not speak of laws until the student of his own says, "How strange! I dropped two stones simultaneously, one heavy and one light, and both of them reached the earth at the same moment." He does not speak of mathematics until the student says, "There must be a way to express this more simply." In this way, the Wu Li master dances with his student. The Wu Li master does not teach, but the student learns. The Wu Li master always begins at the center, at the heart of the matter. This is the approach that we take in this book. It is written for intelligent people who want to know about advanced physics, but who are ignorant of its terminology and perhaps of its mathematics. The Dancing Wu Li Masters is a book of essence, the essence of quantum mechanics, quantum logic, special relativity, general relativity, and some new ideas that indicate the direction that physics seems to be moving. Of course, who can know where the future goes? The only surety is that what we think today will be a part of the past tomorrow. Therefore, this book deals not with knowledge, which is always past tense anyway, but with imagination, which is physics come alive, which is Wu Li. One of the greatest physicists of all, Albert Einstein, was perhaps a Wu Li master. In 1938 he wrote, "Physical concepts are free creations of the human mind and are not, however it may seem, uniquely determined by the external world. In our endeavor to understand reality, we are somewhat like a man trying to understand the mechanism of a closed watch. He sees the face and the moving hands, even hears it ticking, but he has no way of opening a case. If he is ingenious, he may form some picture of a mechanism which could be responsible for all the things he observes, but he may never be quite sure his picture is the only one which could explain his observations. He will never be able to compare his picture with the real mechanism, and he cannot even imagine the possibility of the meaning of such a comparison." Most people believe that physicists are explaining the world. Some physicists even believe that, but the Wu Li masters know that they are only dancing with it. I asked Huang how he structures his classes. "Every lesson is the first lesson," he told me. "Every time we dance, we do it for the first time." "But surely you cannot be starting new each lesson," I said. "Lesson number two must be built on what you taught in lesson number one, and lesson three likewise must be built on lessons one and two, and so on." "When I say that every lesson is the first lesson," he replied, "it does not mean that we forget what we already know. It means that what we are doing is always new, because we are always doing it for the first time." This is another characteristic of a master. Whatever he does with the enthusiasm of doing it for the first time. This is the source of his unlimited energy. Every lesson that he teaches or learns is a first lesson. Every dance that he dances for the first time. It is always new, personal, and alive. Isidore I. Rabi, Nobel Prize winner in physics and the former chairman of the physics department at Columbia University, wrote, "We don't teach our students enough of the intellectual content of experiments, their novelty, and their capacity for opening new fields. My own view is that you take these things personally. You do an experiment because your own philosophy makes you want to know the result. It's too hard, and life is too short to spend your time doing something because someone else has said it's important. You must feel the thing yourself." Unfortunately, most physicists are not like Rabi. The majority of them, in fact, do spend their lives doing what other people have told them is important. That was the point Rabi was making. This brings us to a common misunderstanding. When most people say scientist, they mean technician. A technician is a highly trained person whose job is to apply known techniques and principles. He deals with the known. A scientist is a person who seeks to know the true nature of physical reality. He deals with the unknown. In short, scientists discover and technicians apply. However, it is no longer evident whether scientists really discover new things or whether they create them. Many people believe that discovery is actually an act of creation. If this is so, then the distinction between scientists, poets, painters, and writers is not clear. In fact, it is possible that scientists, poets, painters, and writers are all members of the same family of people whose gift it is by nature to take those things which we call commonplace and to represent them to us in such ways that our self-imposed limitations are expanded. Those people in whom this gift is especially pronounced we call geniuses. The fact is that most scientists are technicians. They are not interested in the essentially new. Their field of vision is relatively narrow. Their energies are directed toward applying what is already known. Because their noses often are buried in the bark of a particular tree, it is difficult to speak meaningfully to them of forests. The case of the mysterious hydrogen spectrum illustrates the difference between scientists and technicians. When a white light, such as sunlight, enters a glass prism, one of the most beautiful of phenomena occurs. Out the other side of the prism comes not white light, but every color in the rainbow, from dark red to light violet, with orange, yellow, green, and blue in between. This is because white light is made of all these different colors. It is a combination, whereas red light contains only red light, green light contains only green light, etc. Isaac Newton wrote his famous Optics about this phenomenon 300 years ago. This display of colors is called a white light spectrum. The spectral analysis of white light shows a complete spectrum because white light contains all of the colors that our eyes can see, and some that they cannot see, like infrared and ultraviolet. However, not every spectral analysis produces a complete spectrum. If we take one of the chemical elements, for example, like sodium, cause it to emit light and shine that light through a glass prism, we get only part of a complete spectrum. If an object is visible in a dark room, it is emitting light. If it appears red, for example, it is emitting red light. Light is emitted by excited objects. Exciting a piece of sodium does not mean offering it tickets to the Super Bowl. Exciting a piece of sodium means adding some energy to it. One way of doing this is to heat it. When we shine the light emitted by excited, incandescent, sodium through a prism or a spectroscope, we do not obtain the full array of colors characteristic of white light, but only parts of it. In the case of sodium, we obtain two thin yellow lines. We also can produce a negative image of the sodium spectrum by shining white light through sodium vapor to see what parts of the white light the sodium vapor absorbs. White light passing through sodium vapor and then through a spectroscope produces the whole rainbow of colors minus the two yellow lines emitted by incandescent sodium. Either way, the sodium spectrum always produces the same distinct pattern. It may be composed of black lines on an otherwise complete spectrum of colors, or it may be composed of colored lines without the rest of the spectrum, but it always remains the same. This pattern is the fingerprint of the element sodium. each element emits or absorbs only specific colors. Likewise, each element produces a specific spectroscopic pattern which never varies. Footnote: in practice, some of the lines representing transitions between higher energy states do not appear in absorption spectra. End of footnote. Hydrogen is the simplest element. It seems to have only two components, a proton, which has a positive charge, and an electron, which has a negative charge. We must say it seems to have, because there is not one person alive who has ever seen a hydrogen atom. If hydrogen atoms exist, millions of them can exist on a pinhead, so small are they calculated to be. Hydrogen atoms, quote unquote, is a speculation about what is inside of the watch. We can say only that the existence of such entities nicely explains certain observations that would be very difficult to explain otherwise, barring explanations such as the devil did it, which still may prove to be correct. It is this kind of explanation that drove Galileo, Newton, and Descartes to create what is now modern science. At one time, physicists thought that atoms were constructed in the following way. At the center of an atom is a nucleus, just as the sun is at the center of our solar system. In the nucleus is located almost all of the mass of the atom in the form of positively charged particles, protons, and particles about the same size as protons but without a charge, neutrons. Only hydrogen has no neutrons in its nucleus. Orbiting about the nucleus, as the planets orbit the sun, are electrons, which have almost no mass compared with the nucleus. Each electron has one negative charge. The number of electrons is always the same as the number of protons, so that the positive and negative charges cancel each other, and the atom, as a whole, has no charge. The problem with comparing this model of the atom with our solar system is that the distances between an atomic nucleus and its electrons are enormously greater than we picture the distances between the sun and its planets. The space occupied by an atom is so huge, compared with the mass of its particles, almost all of which is in the nucleus, that the electrons orbiting the nucleus are like a few flies in a cathedral, according to Ernest Rutherford, who created this model of the atom in 1911. This is the familiar picture of the atom that most of us learned in school, usually under duress. This is the familiar picture of the atom that most of us learned in school, usually under duress. Unfortunately, this picture is obsolete, so you can forget the whole thing. We will discuss later how physicists currently think of an atom. The point here is that the planetary model of the atom formed the background against which a most puzzling problem was solved. The spectrum of hydrogen, the simplest of the atoms, contains over 100 lines. The patterns of the other elements are even more complicated. When we shine the light from excited hydrogen gas through a spectroscope, we get over 100 different lines of color in a distinct pattern. The question is, how can such a simple thing like a hydrogen atom, which has only two components, a proton and an electron, account for such a complex spectrum? Footnote: accurately speaking, different experimental equipment is required to photograph each series of the hydrogen spectrum. Therefore, most single photographs of the hydrogen spectrum show only about 10 lines. Theoretically, there are an infinite number of lines in each atomic spectrum. In fact, theoretically, there are an infinite number of lines in each series of each spectrum because the lines in the higher frequency range of each series become so closely spaced that, in effect, they form a continuum. End of footnote. One way of thinking about light is to ascribe wave-like properties to it and then to say that different colors have different frequencies, just as different sounds, which also are waves, have different frequencies. Arnold Sommerfeld, a German physicist who was also an accomplished pianist, observed, tongue-in-cheek, that hydrogen atoms, which emit over 100 different frequencies, must be more complicated than grand pianos, which emit only 88 different frequencies. It was a Danish physicist named Niels Bohr who came up with an explanation, in 1913, that made so much sense that it won him a Nobel Prize. Like most ideas in physics, it is essentially simple. Bohr did not start with what was theoretically known about the structure of atoms. He started with what he really knew about atoms. That is, he started with raw spectroscopic data. Bohr speculated that electrons revolve around the nucleus of an atom, not just at any distance, but in orbits or shells, which are specific distances from the nucleus. Each of these shells, theoretically there are an infinite number of them, contains up to a certain number of electrons, but no more. If the atom has more electrons than the first shell can accommodate, the electrons begin to fill up the second shell. If the atom has more electrons than the first and second shells combined can hold, the third shell begins to fill, and so on, like this. Shell number one, number of electrons, 2. Shell number 2, 8 electrons. Shell number 3, 18 electrons. Shell number 4, 32 electrons. Shell number 5, 50 electrons, etc. His calculations were based on the hydrogen atom, which has only one electron. According to Bohr's theory, the electron in the hydrogen atom stays as close to the nucleus as it can get. In other words, it is usually in the first shell. This is the lowest energy state of a hydrogen atom. Physicists call the lowest energy state of any atom its ground state. If we excite an atom of hydrogen, we cause its electron to jump to one of the outer shells. How far it jumps depends upon how much energy we give it. If we really heat the atom up, thermal energy, we cause its electron to make a very large jump all the way to one of the outer shells. Smaller amounts of energy make the electron jump less far. However, as soon as it can, when we stop heating it, the electron returns to a shell closer in. Eventually, it returns all the way back to shell number one. Whenever the electron jumps from an outer shell to an inner shell, it emits energy in the form of light. The energy that the electron emits is exactly the amount of energy that it absorbed when it jumped outward in the first place. Bohr discovered that all of the possible combinations of jumps that the hydrogen electron can make on its journeys back to the ground state, the first shell, equals the number of lines in the hydrogen spectrum. This is Bohr's famous solution to the grand piano mystery. If the electron in a hydrogen atom travels from an outer shell all the way to the innermost shell in one jump, it gives off a certain amount of energy. That makes one line in the hydrogen spectrum. If the electron in a hydrogen atom makes a tiny jump from an outer shell to the next shell inward, it gives off a much smaller amount of energy. That makes another spectral line. If the electron in a hydrogen atom jumps from shell 5 to shell 3, for example, that makes yet another line. A jump from shell 6 to shell 4, and then from shell 4 to shell 1, makes two more spectral lines, and so on. In this way, we can account for the entire hydrogen spectrum. If we excite a hydrogen atom with white light instead of heat, we can produce the absorption phenomenon that we mentioned earlier. Each electron jump from an inner shell to a shell farther out requires a certain amount of energy, no more and no less. An electron jump from shell 1 to shell 2 requires a certain amount of energy, and only that amount. The same is true for a jump from shell 5 to shell 7, etc. Each jump that the electron makes from an inner shell to an outer shell takes a specific amount of energy, no more and no less. When we shine the white light on a hydrogen atom, we are offering it a whole supermarket of different energy amounts. However, it cannot use all that we have to offer. Only certain specific amounts. If its electron jumps from shell 1 to shell 4, for example, it takes that particular energy package out of the array of energy packets that we are giving it. The package that it takes out becomes a black line in the otherwise complete spectrum of white light. A jump from shell 3 to shell 4 becomes another black line. A jump from shell 1 to shell 2, and then from shell 2 to shell 6, there are all sorts of combinations, makes two more black lines. In sum, if we shine white light through hydrogen gas and then through a prism, the result is the familiar white light spectrum, but with over 100 black lines in it. Each of these black lines corresponds to a specific energy amount that was required to make a hydrogen electron jump from one shell to another shell farther out. These black lines in the white light spectrum form exactly the same pattern that we get when we shine the light emitted from an excited hydrogen gas directly through a prism, except in that case the lines are colored and the rest of the white light spectrum is missing. Of course, the colored lines are caused by the electrons returning to lower level shells and in the process emitting energy amounts equal to what they absorbed when we first made them jump. Bohr's theory permitted physicists to calculate the frequencies of the light given off by simple hydrogen atoms. These calculations agreed with observations. The grand piano mystery was solved. Shortly after Bohr published his theory in 1913, an army of physicists began the work of applying it to the other elements. This process was quite complicated for atoms with large numbers of electrons, and not all of the questions that physicists had about the nature of atomic phenomena were answered. Nonetheless, a tremendous amount of knowledge was gained from this work. Most of the physicists who went to work on Bohr's theory, applying it and further developing it, were technicians. Bohr himself, one of the founders of the new physics, was a scientist. This is not to say that technicians are not important. The technician and the scientist form a partnership. Bohr could not have formulated his theory without the wealth of spectroscopic data at his disposal. That data was the result of countless laboratory hours. It was beyond Bohr's capacity as one person to substantiate his theory. Technicians did this for him by applying it to the other elements. Technicians are important members of the scientific community. However, since this is a book about Wu Li masters and not about technicians, we will use the word physicist from now on to mean those physicists who are also scientists, that is, those physicists, people, who are not confined by the known. From the little that we know about Wu Li masters, it is evident that they come from this group. There are certain limitations which no book on physics can overcome. First, there is so much to present that not even 20 volumes could contain it all. There is that much new material published each year. Even physicists find it impossible to keep abreast of the whole field. It requires a steady diet of reading just to keep current in one area. For everything that is included in these pages, there is much more that is not. No matter how much you learn about physics, there always will be something that is new to you. Physicists have this problem too. Second, no complete appreciation of physics is possible without mathematics. Nonetheless, there is no mathematics in the dancing Wu Li masters. Mathematics is a highly structured way of thinking. Physicists view the world in this way. One point of view is that they impose this structure on what they see. Another point of view is that the world presents itself most completely through such structures. In any case, mathematics is the most concise expression of physics. The reason for writing The Dancing Wu Li Masters, however, is that most physicists are not able to explain physics very well without it. This makes them very concise, but unfortunately unintelligible. The fact is that most of us use words to do our explaining. However, it is important to remember that mathematics and English are both languages. Languages are useful tools for conveying information, but if we try to communicate experiences with them, they simply do not work. All a language can do is talk about an experience. Wu Li masters know that a description of an experience is not the experience. It is only talk about it. This is a book about physics. Therefore, all it contains is a description. It cannot contain the experience itself. This does not mean that you will not have the experience of physics by reading it. It only means that if you do, the experience is coming from you and not from the book. Quantum mechanics, for example, shows us that we are not as separate from the rest of the world as we once thought. Particle physics shows us that the rest of the world does not sit idly out there. It is a sparkling realm of continual creation, transformation, and annihilation. The ideas of the new physics, when wholly grasped, can produce extraordinary experiences. The study of relativity theory, for example, can produce the remarkable experience that space and time are only mental constructions. Each of these different experiences is capable of changing us in such ways that we never again are able to view the world as we did before. There is no single experience of physics. The experience always is changing. Relativity and quantum mechanics, although generally unknown to non-physicists, are more than a half century old. Today, the entire field of physics is quivering with anticipation. The air is charged with excitement. a feeling is shared among physicists that radical change is at hand. A consensus grows that the near future will see new theories exploding onto the scene, incorporating the older theories and giving us a much larger view of our universe and, consequently, of ourselves. The Wu Li masters move in the midst of all this, now dancing this way, now that, sometimes with a heavy beat, sometimes with a lightness and grace, ever flowing freely. Now they become the dance, now the dance becomes them. This is the message of the Wu Li masters, not to confuse the type of dance that they are doing with the fact that they are dancing.